You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory. You lived in England, and you trained llamas. That's not what I was expecting for the Solicitor General of Indiana. How did you get to England? Why were you in England?
Well, parents' job took us over there when I was in high school.
Okay. And the llamas were just there?
The llamas were in the U.S. There used to be a llama farm at like 71st in Allisonville.
Oh, so you weren't training llamas in England?
No.
Oh, I thought you trained llamas in England, because that's kind of weird. You train llamas in the States. I mean, I guess that's weird enough. But why llamas? Why did you have llamas?
It was a good way to get out and, you know, do farm work.
What training do llamas really need?
Like, well, it depends what you're doing. Shake? So there's the standard showmanship competitions where you have the llama stand pretty and sort of, you know, do what they're supposed to the llama limbo, where it's exactly what you think. They go under a bar and they keep going, and it gets lower and lower, and they, you know, squirm under it, and if they knock it off, they're out.
Do these people have conferences and conventions? Like, are these the same people that go to Comic-Con?
Like, no, we go to, like, the state fair.
Okay. This is news to me. I didn't know that llamas could do the limbo.
They can't.
Wow. And so that's what you trained them to do these tricks.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, folks. Llama trainer, Solicitor General of Indiana. Wow, James Barta, thanks for being here today. So you are the Solicitor General of Indiana. I don't think most people know what that is. What is that? I mean, I think I know, but tell me.
Well, I'm a lawyer who works for the state of Indiana.
Okay.
And the role I occupy combines the roles of advocate, legal strategist, advisor. So, you know, as you probably know, we have an Indiana, like all states, has an attorney general who's chief legal officer. Whenever the state, its agencies, its officials end up in court, the attorney general is representing them. The mm-hmm. attorney general also issues official opinions to advise officials as to what the law is. He obviously can't do all of this on his own. So there's an entire office with attorneys who have different roles supporting these different functions. And so what the Solicitor General role is really designed to be is a role where you are providing high quality legal representation on some of the disputes that are most important to the state and the attorney general. So those would be constitutional challenges to state statutes. Those could be litigation against the federal government, where the state is challenging federal rules or regulations. As well, and then there's that's a lot of what the Solicitor General does, is providing representation for the state in those disputes. But of course, there's more that you don't always, you know, doesn't always make the front page, or isn't always visible. There's roles in terms of helping formulate legal strategy of how do you advance a position over time, because not every dispute is the one where you want to be pressing an issue. And there's a lot of coordination that happens in the office to make sure the positions that the office is taking over time and in different areas are consistent. And then, of course, there's, providing input on, as the office is trying to figure out what is its stance on new issues or new pieces of legislation, and trying to understand what is going to be the impact of these legal developments on the state and its functions.
So the Solicitor General is arguing on behalf of the state. They're not really the attorney. I feel like the Attorney General is prosecuting more things, but is the solicitor, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm probably using the wrong terms. I apologize. But the Attorney General is kind of making advances or prosecuting things, whereas you're defending the state, or
no? So it's the Attorney General is the state's chief legal officer. So if the state is sued, the Attorney General's office is representing the state in court. Or if the state is suing someone else, like the federal government,
right,
the Attorney General's office is also representing the state. It's not really a role of prosecution or defense. And as an aside, Indiana has county prosecutors who handle most criminal prosecutions at the trial level.
Right.
But it's more of a division of function. Is, you know, the Attorney General, he's the one that the voters elect, that, he's the one who oversees the entire office. Okay. He's the one who, you know, ultimately has the final say of what is the state's position going to be. You know, my role is to support that.
Okay. Wow. So you're not elected. Are you appointed?
I'm appointed.
You're appointed. So what was that process like? Did you have to interview? And
there were interviews. Yeah. There were tough questions.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And they looked at your history, I'm guessing, taught at Georgetown, you did litigate in front of the Supreme Court.
I did, yes.
You did. Okay. So they looked at all those things, and they're like, yeah, this is the guy that we want. Did it help to be an Indiana native, Hoosier?
I think so.
You think it did help?
At the end of the day, the attorney general's here to represent the people of Indiana. And,
right.
You know, from my perspective, it's always been a little weird if you have the people who are representing Indiana who've never lived in Indiana, who aren't Hoosiers.
Right. Okay. So it did help you. Tell me about your time at Georgetown. So that's significant, right? So you went, is that where you did your JD or where did you?
Yeah. So I went to law school. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So you went to law school at Georgetown?
I went to law school at Georgetown.
Yeah.
Had a wonderful experience there. Learned a lot.
Okay.
And then after Georgetown, I went off to Michigan to clerk for two different federal judges.
Okay.
And when I came back to D.C., my former professors, Lee and Bill Lotus, invited me to come teach a class with them. So we taught for a couple of times a class called Conservatism in the Law.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What was that about?
So the class was really a class on, you know, answering the big questions. What is law? What is the role of judges? Mm-hmm. What is the role of the courts? And much of it was, you know, reading sort of seminal legal classics from Aristotle to the present day, asking and trying to get students to really engage with these hard questions and think critically about the law, which is something that's very easy not to do.
Interesting. So that's a JD course, or is that an undergrad course?
That's a JD course.
Okay. And they're just now reading those classics when they're doing their law degree. They're not reading that beforehand.
I mean, I think part of it is you have in law school, students who come from a lot of different backgrounds. You have people who majored in chemistry. You have people who majored in history. So not everyone has the same exposure. Right. But I think, you know, more broadly across American education, you don't, it's quite rare to read some of these classic works that have shaped, education for centuries.
Yeah.
And so for many students, this was their first exposure to Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas or Augustine.
Yeah, and I can understand that because that's, you know, in my neck of the woods in the humanities with theology and things like that, you know, we're often assigned texts that aren't original authors. Well, that aren't, you know, like if you take Calvin, for example, we're assigned books about Calvin more than we're assigned books that, you know, Calvin actually wrote. Or, you know, even in philosophy courses, we're reading modern philosophers' take on Plato and Aristotle and not necessarily reading Plato and Aristotle. Now, there's been changes in that in recent curriculum, and so that's been good, and thankfully had to read those guys. So I think that's across the board. You know, people aren't reading Shakespeare. They're reading about Shakespeare now. I guess that's the same thing for law school as well. But,
I think so. And also just the time period is, you know, a lot of modern education, particularly in political science, is sort of focused, you know, much more recent eras than, you know, the time of the ancient Greeks and Romans.
Right. Yeah. Everything has to be trendy. So tell me about some cases that I feel like I'm going to hit the wrong word. Litigated as a solicitor general or prosecuted? Am I using the right words?
Litigated sounds great.
Litigated sounds great. Okay.
You know, which really just means, you know, representing the state in these cases, filing briefs, presenting argument, taking depositions, the whole nine yards.
Okay. All right. So some cases that you've done as a solicitor general, what have you been working on?
So it really spans the range. And that's one of the things I like most about the job is no 2 days are the same. So, you know, if you look over the last couple of months, a few cases that were, you know, we've had, you know, court appearances or briefs filed, it's everything from a case about municipal annexations, about a new state statute that changed the process for municipal annexations, and there was a constitutional challenge to it. You know, some of the bigger headline ones were, you know, defending Indiana's law that, you know, prohibits gender transition procedures for minors.
Okay.
You know, that's a you know, you've probably heard about it in the news, sort of a very, you know, very fraught issue with some very, you know, severe consequences for those who undergo these procedures. And then you have, there's other laws we've been, you know, we've filed some briefs at the U.S. Supreme Court in various cases, such as about the federal government's attempt to take this several decades old law and transform it into a statute that gives, you know, a supposed right to an abortion. We filed a brief in a case about, you know, an attempt by some other government officials to suppress speech.
Interesting. So those are the things that, even though they're at the federal level, you're working on them because they affect Indiana.
They affect Indiana and its people. So I think, you know, a perfect example would be, you know, probably you couldn't miss it, but there was a case at the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this year concerning, you know, Colorado kicking the, you know, former President Trump off the primary ballot.
Heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, so Indiana with West Virginia filed an amicus brief in that case, which is just a
friend
brief.
Of the court.
Friend of the court.
Thank we're you. Just, we're, I got one.
There you go. Your Latin's coming
in
handy.
Yeah, I did take Latin, yeah.
We're you know, joined by 25 other states where we said, you know, came in and presented a perspective on it. And the perspective there was, you know, presidents are nationally elected. You know, every, you know, this is one of the two positions that our Constitution gives where every voter across the nation has input into it. And so if one state is taking a candidate off the ballot, that starts to affect voters in other states like Indiana. All of a sudden, the people of Indiana who vote for a particular candidate, their votes don't count as much. It's harder for their candidate to get elected, and that starts changing what they do. And so I think that's an example of an issue where you, you know, maybe at first glance you think, well, this is about Colorado. Or this is about politics. Well, you know, if you actually think, you know, take a step back and sort of think about it, well, it actually impacts the interest of Indiana and its people in a very practical way. And so a lot of what, you know, my role is, you know, when legal disputes come up, is looking at them and trying to figure out, you know, what is the impact on the state, on its laws, on its agencies, on its people? Because, you know, at the, you know, it's, at the end of the day, the, you know, we're not here just to, you know, represent, you know, just do whatever we think is good. At the end of the day, we are still the state's lawyers. And, you know, that's a very, sometimes a very fraught question about, you know, what is the state? But, you know, that's expressed through its laws, through the decisions its elected officials make, through, you know, what its people have voted for. And so that is our client at the end of the day, is trying to make sure that we're protecting the state in its interest.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you spent time in D.C., obviously at Georgetown, and did some teaching there. But were you also a professional attorney at the time?
Yeah, I worked for a private law firm in the D.C. area for a number, for about 7 years. You know, learned a lot while I was there, sort of, you know, took, went from a baby lawyer to a lawyer who knew a few things. Still feel very young at times, but, you know,
that's
but got to hone some skills and, and work on just a, you know, a variety of really fun cases, you know, from everything about, you know, intellectual property to challenges to energy regulations to, you know, we had a couple cases at the U.S. Supreme Court as well where I got to work on.
So the Solicitor General isn't, again, my ignorance, but isn't as specialized as, say, doing just, you know, patent law or tax law or whatever. You kind of have to have a broad
you have to be a generalist.
A generalist, Solicitor General.
Okay.
That's not like a general like this, right? That's a different kind of general.
Different kind.
Gotcha. So you were in front of the Supreme Court doing something, which is kind of cool. What cases, what were you arguing? Not, sorry, not arguing. What were you litigating in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and the Supremes?
So we've had a couple. I've had a couple of different ones that I've been privileged to work on. You know, one of the first was actually a case that grew out of the, you know, 9/11 attacks, where you had some people who were detained after those suing federal prison officials for detaining them. And so my, you know, this was at the private law firm where we got to step in and represent the officials. And the question was really, you know, can courts create a new realm of liability for federal officials. Another more recent case was in the patent context, but really concerned the president's power to appoint judges who are going to decide administrative disputes. Is this something where, you know, the Constitution gives the president the power to appoint officials? You know, and one of the really big topics is, you know, that has arisen in administrative law is making sure that that power is, you know, actual mechanism for keeping people accountable. And if you start having a lot of different statutes or other protections that interfere with that, that starts to affect the president's ability to keep people accountable and honest in their work. Hmm. So we had that case. And then, you know, more recently, about a year and a half ago, I was out there with the Indiana Attorney General's office, where we were arguing about presenting argument in a question about the spending clause. That's the constitutional power that gives the federal government the ability to spend money. Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, and so there's a lot of questions that have arisen about what are the limits on that power. And so yeah. In what circumstances can people sue to, enforce grant conditions? And our team was out there at the U.S. Supreme Court presenting argument in the case.
Wow, that's cool. So were you in one of those silly little like watercolor paintings?
Did
you get in one of those?
I have not gotten one of those, to my knowledge. I was in a little chair next to the guy who was.
You're like in that whited out section that's kind of blurry.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That'd be cool. Like you could give people your card and have that painting on it. But maybe next time you can inch a little closer to the guy. Yeah, that's super cool. I mean, it's not every day you get to talk to somebody that's been in front of the Supreme Court. So,
and one of the shocking things probably you would find is if you go there is how close you are to the justices. You know, you hear about them on news.
I figured they were like way up
there.
Yeah,
you
the
think
dais.
So. Well, no, you're sitting about 7-8 feet from them.
Interesting. What were they like? Yeah. Are they personable?
They're people.
They're people.
You know, I mean, everyone has their different own personality. You mentioned teaching at Georgetown while we were doing that. Justice Thomas invited our class to go, meet with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, whatever you think about his decisions, he is just a fantastic person.
Yeah.
I think our class was allotted like, 45 minutes or something, but he took 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
To go around and talk with everyone in the class and just ask, where are you from? Tell me about yourself. Hmm. And just spent that time getting to know them, sharing his life, things he's learned over the years. And it was just a really, I think that speaks volumes as to, his priorities and who he is. Mm-hmm. And, you never know he was on the Supreme Court. He just seems like a really genuine person with a huge laugh who wants to get to know people.
Who was the most recent Supreme that was... appointed when you were there? I'm trying to think of the era that you were there. So who was the last one? The youngest
Justice Jackson.
Oh, okay. Oh, so that's recent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was thinking back in your Georgetown days or back when you lived in D.C., but I guess as the Solicitor General, you've been out there and argue.
That was before I became the Solicitor General, but yes.
Okay. So what's the next... what's next for James Barta? I mean, should we be getting like governor bumper stickers here soon? I mean, is that do you have high hopes or?
I don't think so. You don't have to tell us. I don't think so. Okay. I stepped into this role as Solicitor General fairly recently, and my focus is on being the best Solicitor General.
What a good answer. That's good. That's a good. You're looking at the game in front of you, not next season. I understand. That's cool. Obviously, I know you because we go to church together, which has been fun, and gotten to know you a little bit at church. So you're a Christian and you're working out in the public sphere. What do you think is the role of a Christian being faithful in government, in the public sphere? How do you navigate those waters?
Well, in many ways, I don't think it looks a lot different than being a faithful Christian in any other vocation. You know, you are there to, in your character, in the decisions, in how you work, to represent Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the day, that's going to, there's going to be a lot of similarities of doing your work as unto the Lord, as, mm-hmm. Being a principled and standing by those principles and not compromising on your beliefs. Those are all, areas of continuity. I think, where, if anything, it's just that the effects of faithfulness matter more when you're in positions of government. I mean, because, you know, as when you're involved in government, the decisions you make affect people beyond you. And so I think if any, it's really a, just a matter of, I think, you know, sort of how far are the ripples in the pond going to go as to whether you're faithful or not faithful as a Christian.
Yeah. Do you, are you a persona non grata? Do you feel like at the, in your field or in your office, or do you feel like people treat you as fairly as they would anybody else?
I mean, I think I work with wonderful colleagues across the office. You know, I think very highly of them. I think we get along very well. And, you know, even with people we are on opposing sides of cases, you know, it's important to make an effort to be civil to them, to, you know, get to know them, to, you know, to treat them well as Christ would. You know, part of that is just being a faithful Christian. You know, part of it is also the reality that people you litigate across from, you're going to have to keep working with. And so it does no one any good to, you know, go out of your way to be a jerk to someone. Or, you know, whether you're a Christian or not.
Well, I mean, we are called to love our neighbors, and that takes a different, it looks like different things in different, in different fields. You know, it's not just loving your neighbor isn't just, you know, picking up the kid's bike that's in your driveway and putting it back where it belongs. Like, there's, there are different ways to love your neighbor, but,
right. So we're not going to go, you know, compromise our position in court just because we think, you know, want to be nice to someone.
I understand.
But how you do it, are you going to treat them with respect? Are you going to be cordial to them? That, you know, that is something we can't.
Which is a very Christian principle. And I think this often gets overlooked, because many, I'm just going to say many Christians in the public sphere often don't utilize or treat the image of God in each person well, right? So at core, you know, central to the Christian belief system is that each person is created in the image of God. Christian or not, this is what what we believe is how they're created. And so I think it's important that Christians treat people that they're created in the image of God. Now, that doesn't mean you never have disagreements or you don't, you know, see eye to eye, you don't separate or whatever, but we can still treat people like this is an immortal being in front of me that was made in the image of God.
For sure.
Yeah, that's cool. So what do you think is, talk to me about your day. What's a day in the life of the Solicitor General? I mean, you, are you the boss in the building or is that the Attorney General? Is he in a different building?
Like, the Attorney General is the boss over the whole office.
Well, he's the boss, right. Yeah. Or she, I don't know who our, I should know who our Attorney General is.
But. Yeah, Todd Rokita.
Todd Rokita. Thanks, Todd. All right, there you go.
So
what is a day?
He's the boss over the whole office. You know, I think day to day for me, a lot of what I do is, you know, read and write, you know, learning about the law, even more about it, learning about disputes, you know, putting together briefs. I mean, the name may deceive you. Briefs aren't exactly brief, you know, 14,000 words, 9,000 words, 40 pages, something like that. So they take a lot of work to craft. And you know, and then there's, of course, conversations you have to have with, you know, state agencies, with other people within the office, with even with other states. There's a lot of our work where we're, you know, working with other states in terms of filing briefs or challenging rules. And so there's a lot of coordination that happens.
That's pretty cool. So what are you reading now? You said, you know, you're reading and writing. What are you working on? Unless you can't say. I don't know if you're top secret or not, but like.
So, I mean, I can tell you what I have done.
Okay, what you have done.
Not in the works.
Not stuff you're, oh, that's cool. It's like attorney-client privilege, is it?
Well, I mean, you know, part of it's that. There's also other, you know, legal protections for, you know, the drafts you work on and, and so on.
Right. So recently then, obviously you were arguing for the, for Indiana, the election issues.
So I think I touched on a couple of those earlier.
You know,
one, there was the election case. There was gender transition procedures, annexation, First Amendment issues. You know, the other, you know, we've had other cases where, you know, regarding challenges regarding abortion. Sort of, it's, you know, lots of different topics.
Who are the states that we partner with in these types of things? Who are the other...
So we have a lot of
friends of the court.
I mean, we have a lot of partners out there. You know, we've worked, I've worked frequently with West Virginia on another issues, actually a, until recently, a college classmate of mine was the Solicitor General of West Virginia.
Oh, look at that.
then, you know, worked with Ohio. Mm-hmm. We have a, you know, case at the Supreme Court right now where we've worked on it with Ohio. Others include Utah, Idaho, Missouri, Alabama. It really,
okay.
You know, each state, you know, states oftentimes right. have different issues of interest or focus. And so if one of those comes up, we may partner with them.
But there's probably a set, not a set, what am I trying to say? We're probably not going to partner with certain states just because we have different views on things, I'm guessing. Like, we're probably
It's more rare, but, you know, there are issues that cut across the political divide. Yeah. I think, you know, one we had not too long ago was an issue about trains blocking roads.
Okay.
It doesn't matter where you are, whether you're Oregon or Illinois or Indiana or Ohio. Okay. No one likes trains blocking the roads.
Right.
And so that was a case where we had states coast to coast who signed on to the brief.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So that's cool that you can find some things to work with California mm-hmm. and Oregon on, and Massachusetts, I'm guessing, like some of these states that you probably that are not flyover country, is
right.
what I've heard us called. So you can find common ground on some of those things because you're arguing for your citizens. I mean, at the end of the day, you're trying to take care of Hoosiers. And
that's right. And on some issues, you know, consumer protection issues are a good example. Mm-hmm. That affects people across the United States.
Yeah.
And even though in today's political environment, states don't always see eye to eye on sort of respective roles of federal and state government, there are, you know, sometimes issues that come up where states uniformly think the federal government has overstepped. And, mm-hmm. and sometimes that's an opportunity to, you know, create a very, you know, broad bipartisan coalition.
Yeah. Hmm. So your downtime, what do you do for fun? Obviously, you can't read and write all the time.
No, I can't.
What does the rest of your day look like?
So I love getting outside when I can. So my wife, Gabby, and I go for a lot of walks in the evenings, especially now that it's warming up.
Yeah. You know, finally.
Played Frisbee.
There you go. Little known fact, Ultimate Frisbee.
That's
a thing for you.
That's right. Yeah. That's
did that take you back to college days, or how did you know?
Started in college.
Okay.
I played for a lot in college. We didn't have much in terms of sports facilities, but we did have grass. So, all you need is a Frisbee. It's grass and a few cones.
Yeah.
So played a lot in college, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then sort of in the last couple years, picked it back up when my now wife, Gabby, invited me to go play Frisbee.
Is that how you met?
Like,
I mean, is it
that's
blind date?
No, we sort of bumped into each other at work, but got to know each other playing Frisbee.
That's pretty cool. That's good. Yeah, it's a fun sport, and I like it because it's accessible for everybody, even if you're not the most athletic or whatever. Anyone can just, you know, more
it's
or less anyone can do it.
You can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do some of that.
Yeah.
Do some, you know, I do audiobooks in my spare time. Mm. So listening to one, Peace Child, right now by Don Richardson.
What's that about?
Don Richardson was a missionary to tribes in New Guinea. And so it's telling his experience with the tribe.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be good. Peace Child. I'll have to write that down. That sounds like a good one. So audiobooks, outdoor stuff. Do you travel? I mean, do you get back to England ever? Or
not recently.
Not recently.
I mean,
you're busy.
Have done some travel.
Yeah.
So, not much since our honeymoon, which was out to Hawaii, but.
Good choice.
Yeah. Got to see a volcano.
Yeah.
Really wonderful.
I didn't circle back to the England thing, and I meant to. You were there in high school. A couple years. Two years. What do you remember? What did you like? Well, I mean, that's pretty cool experience as a high schooler to be able to live overseas for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you might imagine, with moving in high school, there's some challenges.
My goodness.
But at the same time, it was really formative in my life. I think, you know, brought me much closer to the Lord, closer to family, and just got to have some really cool experiences. I think before that, the most exotic place I had been was, Canada.
Yeah.
So where it was like, they serve potatoes at KFC instead of biscuits. This is a really cool cultural experience.
Very exotic.
And now it's, several steps beyond that.
Yeah.
And so we, got to go to, do some travel around England, a little bit around Europe, got to see things I'd never experienced before and just understand how a different English-speaking culture could actually view issues very differently.
Right, our cousins.
That includes the Christian community. Mm-hmm. While we were there, we were part of a you know, for England, sort of a standard size, but by U.S. standards, very small church of mm-hmm. about 35 people.
Okay.
You know, within that church, there were people from all over the world, from Nigeria, Iran, you know, England, Scotland.
Oh, cool.
But, you know, but it, that just gave us another perspective on what does it look like to live the Christian life in a different culture, in a different context, and, you know, had a lot of things we really appreciated about how they were going about living out their lives and try to emulate.
Did you get to participate in any, like, courtrooms over there, like, to see the difference at all? Like,
No, that was okay. Sort of before I even knew I was going to be a lawyer.
Before you wanted to be a lawyer, okay. Because they do things differently, right? They still wear the wigs.
They wear the wigs. Yeah. They have, you know, only certain lawyers present in court.
Right.
And they have sort of this divide between barristers and solicitors that do work in court and those who don't. And then they're also just do things the English way in court where, you know, how they present material is different from the U.S. It's much more oral driven than written. And you even see things when you read transcripts, like talking about taking a proper lunch for, wow. you know, 2 hours or so.
Proper lunch. And they break for tea, I'm guessing.
I'm sure
maybe,
they do, yeah.
Probably. What's the difference between a solicitor and a barrister over there? Do you know?
I once knew, but I'll get it mixed up if I don't.
I only ask because one of my lesser heroes in life is a guy of the same last name, Owen Barfield. Yeah, and he was the solicitor for C.S. Lewis. They were great friends. And I've read that I've read his books. I've obviously read a lot of Lewis. And I've always wondered, well, what does a solicitor do over there? Apparently, he handled his legal affairs, even his estate, I think, after he passed.
Yeah, so I believe solicitors are the lawyers who don't go to court.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
I could be wrong about that.
They get a proper lunch, I'm sure. Yeah,
sure.
So that was cool. You had some international experience living in England. And then I know your family adopted a couple kids and was it Ukraine? Mm-hmm. So were you involved? Did you have to go to Ukraine at all? Or did your parents mostly?
I did go to Ukraine, but not for that reason.
Oh,
so
okay.
I had been a couple years earlier to work with a camp over there.
Oh, okay.
There's a Christian mission called Mission to Ukraine where they put on a summer camp. And so we went to help with that.
Right.
And that was really, a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Did you learn any Ukraine? Or Russian?
I learned a few words here and there.
Yeah.
Mostly the ones that, kids would say when they wanted to push me to push them quicker on the merry-go-round.
Well, real important survival Ukrainian. That's cool. Well, I love what you're doing. I think this is cool that, that you're doing God's work, in my opinion, God's work in the state sphere. I believe in the sphere sovereignty, that there's state, church, family. And I love that you're doing this thing in the state as a Christian, and really appreciate that. And I wouldn't mind so much if you end up a Supreme, a justice. That'd be cool.
I'll invite you over.
Yeah, that's right. Never forget the little people in your life that you. Yeah, that would be fun. I'd like to see you. I'd like to see the Supreme Court one day. So maybe you'll be the one that does that for me. So. Well, thanks for being here. This was a lot of fun. Super stoked for what you're doing, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
Awesome.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
You bet. See you, everybody. So we turned the cameras off, and then we started talking about something really interesting, and they were like, we got to turn that back on. So I made the comment that I think morality precedes legislation, and then you said something better. What was your line?
Well, I think, legislation is inherently a moral expression.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean,
talk about that. What do you mean?
Yeah. So, with the disclaimer, this is my own views.
Yes.
And this is more me as political philosopher.
Right.
Or
philosopher. You're the third person that I've had on here that have had to make a disclaimer. So feel free to say.
Yeah.
It's your personal views.
Personal views.
Not the view of the state of Indiana.
Not the views of the state of Indiana.
Okay.
And also, this is not something I've studied for years, but. We're going to go for it.
Go for it. This is where we go for things. Yeah. So morality precedes legislation, you said.
Yeah. So I think, and this is really getting at, people talk about like shaping culture through law and so on. Like, yes, law does have a role in shaping culture and morals. I mean, that goes back to Thomas Aquinas, who says it has this didactic function. Mm-hmm. It teaches us what is good, what is bad.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, law is, you know, if it doesn't align with the people's culture and morality, it's just sort of going to be a parchment barrier. It's mm-hmm. not something anyone's going to take seriously. And so I think, you know, the deeper things that matter over the long term are not so much elections and law, but culture mm-hmm. and, you know, more, you know, moral formation and religion. All of those things affect law. I mean, who we vote for is going to be driven by how we already think about society, right. about culture, about morals. Hmm.
So legislation, I think, is, to kind of summarize that, legislation is the response to the culture that people already have. And I'm kind of lumping morality into culture, but yeah. I think that's a casual way of saying it is fine. Legislation is going to come from what people already believe.
Absolutely. I mean, especially, I mean, you know, maybe not for, maybe less so in some countries mm-hmm. where they have a different political system, but in the United States, it's right. a system of yeah. representative government.
Right. So I mean, dictatorships, yeah. you know, fiat and divine sovereignty, like that kind of stuff. Like, the, right. you know, we rule because God said we could. I don't mean that. But like, we're a representative situation where we elect our legislators.
Right. So, you know, at the end of the day, if, you know, people think, like, oh, you know, law and politics, this is really important. Well, yes, but culture-shaping activities are even more important over the right. long term. Education is yeah. more important over the long term. So right. I think, you know, you can only do so much on the legal end if you know, culture and society and education are going a different direct trajectory. If that's going to affect what the laws are.
Yeah. I like that. That's really interesting because, you know, a whole lot of effort and resources go into legislation, meaning politics.
Yeah.
Right. And man, I wish we could use those resources instead for citizen formation. But that's going to probably be even more hot button because that's like mixing politics and religion. That's like the first thing. As soon as you say that, that's going to be mixing politics and religion. But yeah, I think it would be cool if we were, if, you know, if we put that much effort into citizen formation. And as Christians, I think we should be, right? I mean, and I'm all yeah. for Christians and politics, but I think that it's kind of like the cart before the horse. Morality is first.
I mean, I think. Yeah, I mean, how people are formed is the most important thing. I yeah. think, you know, that's not a new idea to me. That right. goes back no, to, no. you know, goes back to Aristotle, who we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, right.
But that, you know, it's incredibly important. Yeah.
I think it further back than even Aristotle, from a Christian perspective, it goes back to God and how he created us and, you know,
sure.
put his, we understand things about God just because of creation, right? So the law is written in our hearts, whether we believe it or not, you know, whether we suppress it or we acknowledge it, because the law, if you want to put it in one term, the law has flowed from God's character,
mm-hmm.
his morality, which is obviously perfect and good. So the law is secondary to what is already good. So I don't know. I mean, I wish that, I'm wading into waters I shouldn't be. I wish the churches probably did that first. Like, okay, it's good to be politically active, but are we taking care of are we cleaning up our own house? Are we building strong families? Are we being good citizens, et cetera?
Yeah, and I think that's also a reflection of, you know, Scripture itself. You see very little in the New Testament about, like, you know, what should your policies be? Mm-hmm. It's much more focused on, you know, what should the church be? What yeah. should, you know, what does it look like to be a faithful, you know, member of a family, you know, yeah. of the church?
Yeah, which is inevitably going to affect politics. It's going to affect legislation. I mean, they're not these airtight compartments or containers, rather. They're going to affect one another.
Yeah, I mean, that's happened throughout history.
Yeah. Huh, that's cool. Well, I'm glad we started rolling some more. All right, this time we're done. I mean it. Thanks, James. Main and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana, at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.